skin? Why does it still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. We are dealing with some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. And let me begin our episode with this question. You know, it's very important, actually, to name the child,
right?
And we have so many, I think, traditions or, suggestions recommended to the parents to name the child even before they were born, right?
Yes.
Let me ask you the question from the Islamic perspective, especially I'm talking about the jurisprudential aspect and dimension. So what does Ayatollah Khamenei say about naming the children?
Well, it is the duty of the parents to choose a good name for their child.
Mm.
Not a name that will have negative impact on the child's psyche. Okay. The names of the Ahlul Bayt, like, for example, Muhammad is a good name to choose. Ali, for example, Hassan, Hussein, and Mahdi. Okay, these are some of the best names. And the names of all the imams are good names to choose for the child.
And it's not also fortunate that in the Western world you see the names of Muhammad and Ali becoming actually so frequent.
Yeah, of course.
It's one. I think, if I'm not mistaken, it's Muhammad is the first prevalent name the West.
Yeah, of course. Because both Sunnis and Shias use the same name.
Yes.
Okay? When it comes to the names of the Ahlul Bayt, of course, the Shia Muslims mostly
prefer
to use their names. And, of course, there are some parents, unfortunately, who choose such names that do not give any sense, any meaning, okay?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That does not make any sense.
I see.
So, ultimately, the aftermath of such names is that the child finds himself in a position where he cannot identify himself something. Okay, what is the meaning of your name? He does not, give a meaning for his name. So, and sometimes the names are so bad that they have definitely negative effect on the child. So it is very much recommended by the imams and the infallibles and also by the religious authorities to choose a good name for their child.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, there's another question I would like to ask you, Sheikh, and that is about taking away or walking away with some stuff from the mosque. For example, whether it be muhr or rosary, beads, or any even utensils from the mosque. For example, we know that, because of different ceremonies and ritual services, usually there is a kitchen inside the mosque and they would distribute or hand out, for example, some tea or coffee with some containers, saucers, cups and whatnot, So if somebody takes some of them or walks away with some of these stuff from the mosque, what do we have from the jurisprudential aspect for this rule?
Well, generally speaking, it's not permissible for any individual to misuse or take away with them the belongings of the mosque, the things which belong to the mosque.
Right.
Whether they are the turba, the piece of clay,
right,
or the rosaries, or the carpets, or any other items belonging to the mosque. For example, if the mosque has certain gadgets, and those gadgets are not used even by the mosque, but they still belong to the mosque.
Mm-hmm.
People have no right just to bring up this excuse and say, okay, the mosque does not need it any longer, so I want to use them. That's not acceptable.
I see.
It belongs to the mosque. They belong to the mosque, and they can be sold, and the proceeds can be used to benefit the mosque.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javed, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javed, what are the general jurisprudential laws or Islamic laws regarding loans? If you want to take out a loan or borrow some money from someone, or even lend some money or some loan to someone, what are the general laws?
Well, the question is very general, because yes. You say, okay, what is the Islamic law about loans? Okay, There are different scenarios. It depends whether you borrow from an Islamic bank or a non-Islamic bank.
Yes.
Okay. Or whether you give money, okay.
Does it differ from a bank or a national or, let's say, a local
institution?
Private sector,
yeah.
Or rather than an individual, simple, single person.
Yeah, governmental and private, mm-hmm. Right?
Yes.
So the general answer is that it is not permissible to give and receive usury.
Mm.
And if there is such a stipulation in the contract of loan allowing you to give or requiring you to give interest or receive interest,
mm-hmm.
That transaction is invalid.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for example, if you want to deposit your money on the condition that the bank gives you a certain amount of money, this condition is forbidden.
Mm-hmm.
It cannot be. Yes, it will make the interest or the usury haram to use.
What about the inflation rate? And every country is actually suffering from some kind of inflation. And when you give some kind of a loan, then the value of your money actually decreases as the time passes by.
Well, if there's no such stipulation and you just deposit your money with the bank, there's no such thing as expressing or placing a condition.
Right.
And the bank itself, just to encourage the clients and customers, give a certain amount of incentive or something amount of money to just to motivate people to put their money or assets in the bank,
mm-hmm.
They give certain amount of money or whatever the justification or the reason.
Right.
There's no problem in receiving that amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
And which is received without a prior condition.
Right.
Yeah, that's okay. That's permissible. Even according to, let's say Ayatollah Sistani, he says that, okay, it depends on whether it's a government. Suppose we are investing in a Muslim country.
Right.
And there are Muslim banks. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
If you deposit with your money with a government bank, okay, you can receive half of the interest and distribute, and you should give away and the other half to the poor,
right.
The poor. And if you deposit the money with a private bank,
right.
Right, then if you do not make such a stipulation for interest, the you can collect all the interest that is given to you by the ming, because you did not put any condition in the first place.
Right.
So it's okay to receive that interest.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Tawheed. Let's take another break and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Stay tuned.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma صلي على محمد وآل محمد.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Tawheed, our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, Sheikh Tawheed, what is the law regarding fasting without eating anything at dawn, like what we call sahari, or a kind of breakfast,
yes,
basically, starting the whole spiritual journey of fasting?
Right. Well, the pre-dawn meal is not necessary to eat, yes? But it is recommended,
mm-hmm,
just because you need to stay stay healthy during the day.
Right.
And if you, for example, let's say the weather is hot, you might suffer dehydration.
Right.
Or maybe because of hunger, you might have developed some kind of complications.
Right.
So because of this, it's recommended to wake up before dawn and have a short meal and then make niyyah for fasting. That's not necessary, but it is recommended.
Mm-hmm.
So I think everybody understands this, that it's not necessary for them to wake up. But if they do wake up, it's better, it's good, it's okay, it is good for his health.
Sahab, yes.
Yes, of course.
If I get you right, correct me if I'm wrong, we know that, you know, eating breakfast, starting fasting is recommended, but, you know, iftari, which is usually eaten as, you know, the azan of Maghrib is on, you know, or finished, then, well, you have to actually end your fasting. And this is obligatory, right?
It's not obligatory. It's not obligatory to break your fast at a certain time, you know?
Oh.
It's not obligatory.
But you cannot actually, finish your fasting.
Okay. You can finish your fasting by just saying that I am no longer fasting because it's time for breakfast. When it's time for prayer, your fast is already over, whether you want it or not. Okay, you cannot keep fasting. Okay, you just simply say, okay, it's time for prayer. Okay, you pray and then you break your fast, but it's not wajib to break it.
But we cannot continue our fasting to the next fasting day.
Even if it does happen,
right?
That
if you don't eat anything in between the breakfast, I mean, like iftari, and the next sahari
again, you should continue fasting if you can. You know, for example, if you remain asleep,
isn't there any obligatory basically to eat something in the middle,
It's not obligatory. You know, for example, if you happen to sleep in the evening before dawn, before you break your fast.
Right.
Okay, you remain asleep for some reason until dawn. You find yourself in the waking up in the morning.
Right.
Now, can you break your fast? No, you cannot break your fast because you should keep fasting if you can. But la yukallifullahu nafsan illa wus'aha. God does not obligate you beyond your capacity.
Right.
If you cannot keep fasting, and fasting could be very much injurious to your health, then you should break your fast. And breaking means doesn't mean that you should overeat. Eat as much as you can. Should eat as much as it can, as it helps you stay and, you know, in a good shape and also healthy till the next breakfast.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Tawheed.
Thank you, my dear listeners, for joining your own program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio, in which we try to delve into some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei from me, Muhammad Javad, the host of this program, and our guest speaker, Sheikh Javid. We bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
She's the love of my life, does everything with a smile. She's my mother, my sweet mother. She can take the pain away with just one look. That's my mother, my sweet mother. You're the picture in the frame with all the colors of the rainbow. I'm far from ashamed to say I love you so. It's late, but I can't sleep tonight. Forgive me if I take my time, but I just have to let you know you're so special. She taught me how to pray. We play games every day with my mother, my sweet mother. Even if I made no sense, listen with patience. That's my mother, my sweet mother. She would sing a sweet song till I shut my eyes and kiss my head and say goodnight. And I feel safe with you by my side. You're there for every step in my life. I'm sorry. If only this was true. I'm in a cold, dark, wet room. I was an orphan, and now I'm 22. I've never known my mom. A picture faded by the sun is all I have. Left alone with nothing more but what I am. It's not. Sweet mother.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
As the U.S. closes door, China is opening new ones and redefining Africa's place in the world. There is talk of the continent turning Trump's punitive tariffs into a new opportunity. Now, will Africa rise to reshape its destiny, or will it be left behind in the global power struggle? And joining us today to discuss this important topic is Irete Bakara Yusuf. Now, she is a broadcast journalist and founder of African journalist against genocide. Also with us today is Zizwe Kiguka. Now, he is the organizer for the All African People's Revolutionary Party and the African Party for the Independence of Guinea and Cape Verde. Join us for this week's edition of Africa Today as we discuss how African countries can turn Trump's punitive tariffs into an opportunity. When the United States raised tariffs on African exports to as high as 30% in the case of South Africa, shockwaves rippled across the continent. Overnight, billions in trade were at risk. Uganda, Gabon, and Niger had already lost their duty-free access under a U.S. program known as the African Growth and Opportunity Act. For many, it felt like punishment, but for Africa, it could be a wake-up call. Because while Washington is shutting doors, Beijing is opening them. By 2024, Africa-China trade had surged past $295 billion. In just the first 5 months of 2025, it added another $134 billion. Factories, ports, and railways financed by China are changing the way Africa connects with the world. At the same time, African nations are rethinking their own future. The African Continental Free Trade Area is laying the foundations for the world's largest single market. Across the continent, a new spirit of self-reliance is taking hold. Now, these tariffs aren't just about economics. They are moves in a global power struggle over currency, over alliances, over the future of trade itself. Now, the question is, will Africa turn exclusion into power and claim its place in the new multipolar world order?
Trump's tariffs, Africa's opportunity.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa recently addressed a virtual BRICS leaders' extraordinary summit that focused on the current economic environment and the state of the multilateral system. Now, commenting on the tariffs for imposed by the U.S., he said that we are witnessing seismic shifts in global trade that present both challenges and opportunities. Let's take a listen.
We are witnessing seismic shifts in global trade that present both challenges as well as opportunities in the reordering of the global economy. There is a shift from a unipolar to a multipolar world. This moment is marked by intensifying global competition and growing geopolitical tensions. Unilateral tariff actions are contributing to an increasingly protectionist environment, which poses great hardships and danger for the countries of the Global South. The uncertainty of the new trading regime has already negatively affected employment levels in my own country, South Africa, and is an obstacle to our economic growth. We are therefore supportive of meaningful BRICS initiatives that improve the resilience of our economies as BRICS countries.
Well, the South African president, they are speaking of new opportunities for Africa amid the trade war imposed by the U.S. president on Africa. Now, let's start off with Ireti Bakare Yusuf. Given the recent discussions surrounding the tariffs imposed on African exports by the U.S., do you believe Africa should view these as an opportunity to reduce its reliance on Western markets?
I think it's important that Africa begins to actually take control and steer and sort of pull away more and more from its dependency on Western markets. Why is that? Because Africa needs to realize the only way that Africa can grow is to continue or begin to do more and more business with the within themselves, within Africa, across the region, and, you know, pull away from the powers that the Western region had over Africa. Indeed, the only way we can actually begin to see a growth, and if you like, a Viva Africa, a fully independent Africa, an Africa that works for Africans, and indeed her massive youth, is to actually continue to do business.
Thank you. Now, let's bring in Zizwe Kiguka. Do you think Africa's ongoing efforts to reduce reliance on the U.S. through initiatives like the African Continental Free Trade Area will help shield the continent from the impacts of a U.S. trade war?
The Africa Free Trade Agreement will definitely help to buffer the African nation states against the tariff policies of the current U.S. administration, basically because Africa is the richest continent on earth, and the economies of Africa, they need to be integrated so that they're not so dependent on foreign direct investment or foreign markets. Many of the nation states in Africa are dependent upon U.S. foreign market for sales. But if we integrate the economies of Africa, and the African Free Trade Agreement is a step in that direction, we will become less dependent upon the U.S. economy as a foreign market.
President Donald Trump's aggressive tariff policies, particularly the imposition of reciprocal tariffs of up to 50% on imports from countries with trade surpluses with the U.S., have significantly disrupted global trade dynamics. African nations heavily reliant on U.S. markets for exports like textiles, agriculture, and minerals have been among the most affected. In response, many are actively seeking new markets across Asia to mitigate the adverse economic impacts.
President Trump's recent decision to exempt key African minerals like gold, tungsten, uranium, and graphite from U.S. tariffs has raised questions about the underlying motives of these trade policies. Now, the administration justifies these exemptions as necessary to secure critical supply chains vital for sectors like aerospace, electronics, and energy. Now, Mr. Chiguka, how do you interpret this move?
The Trump administration could not put tariffs on those rare earth minerals because of the need for those rare earth minerals. It's the same thing in Africa. There are certain things, mineral resources, like uranium, coltan, etc. The administration in the U.S. cannot afford to put tariffs on those kinds of things because of the need. So they take people as fools, basically, when they have these economic arrangements and negotiations with other countries. And it's also a result of colonialism in the past in Africa that the U.S. government is able to bully people in Africa, the governments in Africa, in terms of making these arrangements to the detriment of the economy of the African nation states. So unification is the key. The integration of the African economy will stop all of those problems that the colonialists and imperialists are trying to impose on the African nation states.
Thanks for that, Mr. Chiguka. Let's now take a short break before we continue our discussion on punitive U.S. tariffs on Africa and how they can be turned into an opportunity for the continent. Stay with us.
Trump's tariffs, Africa's opportunity.
The African Continental Free Trade Area stands as a cornerstone of Africa's development vision under Agenda 2063. Now, a unified market holds immense potential, unlocking boundless opportunities for the continent's growth and prosperity. The Secretary General of this Pan-African body elaborates on the opportunities.
By the year 2035, the AFCFTA market, the combined GDP of the AFCFTA market is estimated to be close to $7 trillion United States dollars. That means that there are opportunities for small medium enterprises, for young entrepreneurs, to export across regions of the African continent and to take advantage of this vast market. However, if we don't have an integrated single market, we will not be able to achieve the positive projections that many around the world have made about the potential of the AFCFTA.
Well, as Africa continues to develop its economic strategies, initiatives like the African Continental Free Trade Area are undermining the U.S. Multilateral trade frameworks with Africa, such as the so-called African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA. This is seen by many as presenting an opportunity for Africa to push for stronger economic integration within the continent itself. Ms. Bakare Yusuf, what are your thoughts on this?
Absolutely, it does. I mean, AGOA, really, yes, Nigeria, my country, was one of the largest users, if not the largest users of AGOA, but, you know, that no longer exists. And again, AGOA was just a way of, you know, it was the American soft power way of controlling African countries. So certainly we should get away. And I can't say, I mean, I can honestly say for myself, I am one of those who sees this as a great, great opportunity for Africa to free itself of the American stronghold. But the question is Africa ready? They need our resources. The same President Trump that's imposing tariffs on South Africa, on Nigeria, etc., that's weaponizing tariffs, is actually, they need the rare earth. He's talking about, oh, I'm stopping the war in Congo, you know, in exchange for natural resources. Well, he hasn't even stopped any war, but I have no doubt he's probably signed the natural resource on how to steal from Congo, how to steal from Sudan, how to steal from Nigeria. Heck, how to steal from as many parts of Africa as possible. And those are the things that we need to stop from happening. If African countries had led the initiative and ensured that the war in Congo, the genocide going on, is actually stopped and they're able to get there and stop it, talk to their brother leaders, put a stop to it, then we wouldn't have had a President Trump who would be able to interlude and claim that he stopped a war, which he hasn't stopped. And must keep saying that he hasn't stopped. What he did was to sign a contract to collect more minerals, to steal, not collect, to actually thieve and steal more minerals from Africa in the future, in order to tell to do a ceasefire that only lasted a few days.
The exclusion of African countries from AGOA presents a significant new opportunity for the continent to reconsider and potentially break free from trade agreements that may have restricted its long-term growth and potential. Now, Mr. Chiguka, how has AGOA's narrow focus on specific industries and reliance on external partners hindered the continent's ability to diversify its economies and pursue more self-sustaining models of development?
Definitely think that this is an opportunity for Africa to unify economically, politically, socially. On the economic front, the African Growth and Opportunities Act was a thing that was used by the imperialist powers to keep a dependency relationship of these newly independent African states. So this would work in our favor to spark a change in Africa to further integrate the African economy. And so the U.S. administration is helping to mobilize our people for greater forms, levels of unity on the economic front. So it's a good thing. It's a good thing that they are actually trying to impose these tariffs. So now we can integrate our economies and be less dependent on the African Growth and Opportunities Act, which is to the disfavor of the African nation states anyway.
China's expanding influence in Africa represents a significant shift from the historically exploitative engagement of Western powers, particularly the United States. Many analysts view the increasing trade between China and African nations as a constructive alternative to the punitive tariffs often associated with U.S. economic policy.
There's a China-Africa summit every year in which the Chinese forgive the debt of many African nation states. And also China has helped to build infrastructure projects throughout Africa, such as the Trans-Am Railroad back in the 70s. So that relationship with China has always been a positive and is increasingly becoming even better with their help financially and economically, so that we are less dependent upon the US and the European imperialists that charge astronomical interest rates on these loans that they give us. Because if you look at all the nation states in Africa that have taken out International Monetary Fund loans, they're still paying the interest and they can't even get to the principal. So therefore, the indebtedness of African nation states to IMF is continuing to rise, whereas China is helping and forgives many of the loans so that we can become less dependent on the International Monetary Fund in Africa.
In response to the U.S.'s aggressive trade policy, there is a growing argument for African countries to focus on de-dollarization and create more independent trade structures within the global south. Now, Mr. Chibuka, how can de-dollarization and the establishment of independent trade structures help African countries mitigate the impact of external economic pressures such as an aggressive trade policy from the U.S.?
Therefore, it is incumbent upon Africa to take this opportunity to break away from the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar was the reserve currency and is steadily declining in terms of nation states that are dependent on the U.S. dollar. So this is an opportunity for Africa to become less dependent and use the mechanism of de-dollarization through the BRICS Alliance and other mechanisms so that when the U.S. dollar declines, finally, it won't affect Africa as much. It won't be as disruptive because the handwriting is on the wall for the U.S. dollar. It is declining on a global scale, and the African nations have to be able to adjust or they will go down if they keep dependency on the U.S. dollar. Therefore, de-dollarization is a must in Africa.
South Africa has been hit hard by the Trump tariffs. The ANC-led coalition government has struggled to respond effectively, while some critics argue that South Africa's response lacked urgency or forcefulness, especially given the economic stakes. Pretoria has clearly taken diplomatic and strategic steps.
Ms. Bakare Yusuf will have the last word today. Now, what steps should African governments take to ensure that they are better prepared for such economic shocks in future?
We wait, like I said earlier, we wait on until the problem lands in our country, slaps us in the face before we start to respond. Why isn't there anybody looking to the future and planning? That is what African countries must do. African leaders must start to look, visionize a really strong and independent Africa and continue to plan, not just plan, implement, not just implement, create the structure, the framework, the foundation to build that vision on. But you can't do that again if you don't invest in your education. So now we come to social structure. You've got to invest in your education because you have to be ready to pass on the baton to the next generation. Yet again, we've got the likes of Paul Biya who are wanting to run again and again and again. So the youth, of course, they feel despondent. They're in despair. They don't see a future.
Well, there you have it. Africa needs to have visionary leaders and invest in education for the continent to be free of manipulation by the likes of Trump. I'd like to thank our guests today, Irechi Bakare Yusuf and Zizwe Chibuka, for their incisive analysis. Now let's proceed to the next part of our program, honoring Africa's remarkable civilizations, which are the cornerstone of its vibrant cultural legacy. In today's fast-evolving world, it's increasingly important for young Africans to reconnect with their heritage. Now, preserving this identity is key to shaping a confident and empowered future. My colleague, Janatali, will share more on this.
Hello, I'm Janet Ali, and welcome to a series of programs that will delve into some of the ancient African civilizations. As Africa moves to become a focal point of the world's economy, reflecting on the continent's rich civilization is critical to preserve its pure identity. Today, let us get to know more about the Songhai civilization. The Songhai Empire, one of the largest and most powerful civilizations in West African history. This civilization emerged in the 15th century and was centered around the Niger River. The empire's capital was the city of Gao, but it also included other significant cities like Timbuktu and Djenne. The rise of the Songhai Empire began under the leadership of Sunni Ali in the 1460s. Sunni Ali expanded the empire's territories through military conquests and established control over crucial trade routes. His successor, Askia Muhammad, further centralized the administration, promoting Islam and implementing a legal system based on Islamic law. Under Askia Muhammad's rule, the empire experienced a golden age marked by political stability, economic prosperity, and cultural flourishing. The Songhai Empire's achievements were numerous. Timbuktu and Djenne became renowned centers of learning, attracting scholars and students from across the Islamic world. The empire's wealth was built on trans-Saharan trade, dealing in gold, salt, and other valuable commodities. The Songhai military was also formidable, utilizing cavalry and riverine forces to maintain control over their vast territories. However, the decline of the Songhai Empire began in the late 16th century. Internal strife and succession disputes weakened the central authority. In 1591, the Moroccan army invaded the Songhai Empire equipped with firearms, which gave them a significant advantage over the Songhai forces. The Battle of Tondibi marked the end of Songhai dominance, and the empire gradually fragmented into smaller states. Despite its decline, the legacy of Songhai civilization still endures. Efforts to preserve the heritage of the Songhai include protecting historical sites like the Sankore Madrasa in Timbuktu, a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Timbuktu's ancient manuscripts, which contain invaluable knowledge on various subjects, are being digitized and preserved to safeguard the cultural and intellectual achievements of the Songhai era. That was a brief description of the Songhai civilization. From me, Janet Ali, it's goodbye for now.
Well, and that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's always great having you. On behalf of the entire crew, it's me, Mubarak Kenya, saying goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
اقرأ باسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا
ودعوتك ربي بقرآنك جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفرانك يا من ينجينا إحسانك ودعوتك ربي
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May the peace and blessings of Allah be upon the soul of Prophet Muhammad and his purified progeny. Dear audience, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another episode of the program, Let's Recite the Quran, coming to you from the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. I'm your host Mahdi, and as always, we are joined by Quran expert, dear brother Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Assalamu alaikum, brother Mahdi. Thank you for having me, and assalamu alaikum to all the dear listeners of this program. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you, brother. Well, dear audience, as you may know, the program Let's Recite the Quran consists of several Quranic parts. First, Brother Muhammad is going to talk about the music or the musical miracle of the Noble Quran. Then, we all are going to listen to a recitation by a famous reciter of the Noble Quran. And at the end, Brother Muhammad is going to analyze that recitation from different aspects. Stay tuned. Well, in the first part of today's program, as always, we're going to talk about the miraculous music of the Noble Quran. We were talking about how impressive the sound the letters of the Noble Quran can be. Brother Muhammad, at your service.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. One of my favorite places in the Quran where you could actually feel the meaning of the word and visualize the thing that's happening in that verse is Surah Maryam, verses 88 to 91. So let me recite these verses. وَقَالُوا اتَّخَذَ الرَّحْمَنُ وَلَدًا. What does this mean? It means they say that the Beneficent One, which means Allah, has taken a son.
Mm-hmm.
That Allah has begotten a son. Now look what happens. لَقَدْ جِئْتُمْ شَيْئًا إِدًّا. What does this mean? It means you have put forth a very monstrous thing that you have said. It's a very extravagant claim. Now, in this verse, look how Allah depicts the message and the meaning of this verse by just the sound of the letters. تَكَادُ السَّمَاوَاتُ يَتَفَطَّرْنَ مِنْهُ وَتَنْشَقُّ الْأَرْضُ وَتَخِرُّ الْجِبَالُ هَدَّا. You could feel that the skies are ready to burst, the earth to split asunder, and the mountains to fall down in utter ruin. تَكَادُ السَّمَاوَاتُ يَتَفَطَّرْنَ. يَتَفَطَّرْنَ means to burst. وَتَنْشَقُّ. It means to split. Just look, we have a letter of shatta with tashdeed. Okay? وَتَنْشَقُّ الْأَرْضُ وَتَخِرُّ الْجِبَالُ هَدَّا. It means the mountains are about to fall down in utter ruin. And دعوا للرحمن ولدا, that they should take a son for the Beneficent. So this really, this is very, it's a very influential verse in terms of negating the idea that God has a son and Jesus is the Son of God. This is what is about to happen if such a thing is true. So the mountains are going to split, the earth is going to, you know, the skies are going to burst, and so on and so forth.
And tashdeed on letters of
shatta.
Tashdeed on letters of shatta makes this intensity doubled, I think.
Yeah, it makes, it intensifies this the meaning. And yes, it, you know, the intensity becomes greater.
Yes.
Whenever you pronounce these letters of explosives, they're explosive letters.
Yes.
And when you give them tashdeed, it adds, it doubles the plosiveness.
Thank you, Brother Muhammad, and thank you, dear audience of IRIB English Radio. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. Today, in the second part of the program, Let's Recite the Quran, we all are going to listen to the recitation of Brother Taha Hosseini reciting Surah Al-Shams from the very beginning to the end of verse 10. Let's enjoy it. Dear audience, you're listening to the program Let's Recite the Quran, and what you just listened to was recitation of Surah Ash-Shams from the very beginning to the end of verse 10, recited by Brother Taha Hosseini. Brother Muhammad, let's talk about this beautiful recitation.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Okay, this recitation by Brother Taha Hosseini was performed when he was a teenager. He was an adolescent, actually. And the thing about adolescents and, in general, children, and as well as women, is that they have a soprano voice. Soprano means that the register of their voice is really high. It can get really, really high, and a lot higher than men's voice.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And we see this, the Jawabul Jawabs of Taha Hosseini, no man can perform these jawab, okay, no matter how high and how extensive his vocal range is. And it's only possible for children and women. But once these children, they reach the age of maturity and they in puberty, their voice cracks, their voice changes and gets a lot deeper.
Mm-hmm.
So they can no longer recite like this. Sometimes this has a negative effect on them, and they lose their hope and they become demotivated a little bit. But they shouldn't be like, they should try to, you know, first of all, in the age of puberty, they should not recite the Quran at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's very bad for their voice, because their voice is just beginning to change and, you know, evolve into a masculine voice.
I think
so. Whenever, if they recite the Quran at this particular stage in their life, it's going to do them a lot of harm, because the voice, you know how it goes, it cracks and it goes like we have this cracking of the voice. It's gonna, you know, it's gonna be really harmful to their voice if they recite the Quran in this way. So they should recite the Quran in low registers, or they shouldn't recite the Quran at all until their voice becomes, you know,
complete
stable, and there's no more cracking of the voice.
I think there might be some exceptions, actually. Sheikh Abdul Basit, Muhammad Abdul Samad.
Yeah, but his voice is still not as high as this. Yeah. He can't get to the soul, even though it sounds as if he's reciting in a very high-pitched voice. In fact, his voice is still not as high as this, as Brother Taha Hussaini is reciting. You know, he has, Sheikh Abdul Basit, he has a very melodious and very smooth voice and very gentle voice. It seems to us that he's reciting in a very high register. It's also because he's applying some pressure on his voice at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still not anywhere as high as this in terms of register. Now the tajweed.
Good idea.
وَالشَّمْسِ وَضُحَاهَا. The word الشَّمْس, we have a sun letter in the word shams. So we have to pronounce the sheen with tashdeed without pronouncing the lam sakina. وَالشَّمْس. And it's interesting that the reason the sun letters are called sun letters is because of the word Shams itself.
Means sun.
Yeah. And وَالْقَمَرِ, we have a moon letter here, just like the word qamar.
Yes,
whenever it
itself
has an alif lam, the lam sakina is pronounced. And that is why they're called
moon letters, actually.
Moon letters, because letters that come after lam and where the lam sakina is pronounced, they're called moon letters. And this is because of the word
al-qamar itself.
Yeah. إذا تلاها والشمس وضحاها والقمر إذا تلاها والنهار إذا جلاها. Look at the rhyme in these verses. Short verses with rhymes. Allah is swearing by
the sun,
whenever it rises, by the moon, by the day, by night, by the sky, the earth. And we have this very good rhythm, this very... it's a rhythm that's very pleasurable to hear.
And each pair of words are antonyms.
Yeah, they're antonyms, and also the verb is related to that word.
Yes.
وَالشَّمْسِ وَضُحَاهَا. By the sun and its splendor, ضُحَاهَا. وَالْقَمَرِ إِذَا تَلَاهَا. And the moon that follows the sun, تَلَاهَا. This is actually another miracle of the Quran, because... at that time, people didn't know that the moon revolves or moves around something and revolves around the sun. Here, Allah is saying, وَالْقَمَرِ إِذَا تَلَاهَا, by the moon, as she follows him, follows the sun. And so as we can see that the pairs, the words and the verb of that word, they're very much related. This makes it very beautiful. And in terms of tajweed, so we said the sun letters and the moon letters. وَالنَّهَارِ إِذَا جَلَّهَا. Again, this is a sun letter. وَاللَّيْلِ. This is another sun letter. وَالسَّمَاءِ. Again, seen as a sun letter. وَالْأَرْضِ. Now, the final one is, not the final one. In the sixth verse, we have a moon letter. And in the word الْأَرْضِ, we have a lot with a kasra. We have to make sure that the tafkhim is not too much. And in fact, it should be at the lowest level.
Yeah, the shape of lips help us to apply the...
وَمَا طَحَاهَا. The ta has a lot of tafkhim. It's a letter of
istilab. At the second highest level, actually.
Not the highest level, the second highest.
Second highest level.
Yeah, is that what you said? The second highest level. Exactly.
Thank you, Brother Muhammad. And thank you, dear audience of IRIB English Radio. That was the final part of the program, Let's Recite the Quran. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. And don't forget to visit our website, that is parstoday.com. Please click on the tab Call of Islam, and there you can listen to this program as well as other programs of this radio. Until next time, we'll leave you in Allah's care. Have a nice time and goodbye. ذكر وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور.